The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Anushka Astana. What does Britain want from Brexit? Theresa May attempts to secure agreement from senior cabinet ministers at a Chequers away day. The Brexit secretary promises it won't be this.
Britain plunged into a Mad Max-style world borrowed from dystopian fiction.
But as David Davis rules out deregulation and dystopia, are his colleagues on board? Brexiteer MPs have listed their demands in a letter with 62 signatories, enough names to topple a prime minister. Also this week, life expectancy in Britain has stalled, and academics claim the Department of Health has ignored repeated warnings that austerity policies may be to blame.
This is the biggest slowdown there has been in life expectancy since the 1890s.
And Agent Corbyn? Or not so much. How the story of a 1987 meeting with a discredited Czech intelligence officer has dominated the Tory press. And whether it's all a fuss over nothing. Not so fast, says our columnist Matthew Dancona.
The bigger danger is to say that the whole thing is just an irrelevance, just an unimportant smear.
But first, Theresa May promises the transition period will be time limited after a leaked document caused anger among Brexiteer MPs. The same backbenchers who also signed a letter setting out their demands for the final EU deal, including full regulatory autonomy. Still with me? Oh yes, the question of post-Brexit regulation is what all the chatter is about in Westminster these days. David Davis says the Tories don't have any secret plans for sweeping deregulation, but instead want to oversee a race to the top in global standards. Do we believe him? Joining me to discuss all that is The Guardian chief leader writer Randeep Ramesh, The Spectator's Isabel Hardman, and the director of the Institute for Public Policy Research, Tom Kibasi. So Isabel, take us round the table at this Chequers retreat. How many different versions of Brexit are vying for the PM's attention?
Well, I think the Cabinet are starting to reach some kind of agreement on some aspects of Brexit, but there is still a fundamental split on how close Britain and the EU remain after Britain leaves the European Union. And I think there's a lot of suspicion, not just in the Cabinet, but in terms of the backbenchers, who Cabinet ministers sort of feel they have to represent, particularly in terms of the transition period between Britain leaving the European Union and actually leaving the European Union, as to how close Britain will remain. So will Britain have control over new laws, for instance? And I think that's one of the major contention points for this Cabinet discussion.
Because Boris Johnson and Michael Gove feel differently to Amber Rudd and Philip Hammond.
Yes, and I think there's a lot of personal feeling in this as well. I think a lot of Cabinet ministers don't trust one another. I think some of that there are still sort of rankling disagreements about how people have briefed the papers about certain things, particularly Boris Johnson and Michael Gove. There's quite a lot of resentment from other Cabinet ministers, particularly Amber Rudd, towards Boris Johnson for the way that they tend to brief first and then discuss with Cabinet colleagues later.
Yeah, you always want to be a fly on the wall when Amber Rudd is sitting opposite Boris Johnson in a Cabinet meeting. Randy, the Brexiteers have most recently got upset about this leaked document. It's basically setting out the government's negotiating position on transition. They're worried that there isn't a specified end date for transition in this document. They say in the document, it says the UK believes the period's duration should be determined by how long it will take people to prepare and implement the new processes and new systems that will underpin the future partnership. Now, the government have had to come back out and say, look, there will be an end date. But tell us why Brexiteers are worried about this.
They're worried about this because they think of it as the Hotel California option, which is, you know, you check in and you can never leave.
I've heard that a few times from Brexiteers.
Yeah,
now you mention it.
That's right. So that's their kind of idea, that we say that we're leaving, we set all these dates, and actually what we do is proceed as if we're still in the club, receiving dictates from, you know, modern day Rome, i.e. Brussels, being a vassal state. You know, this is where this sort of language becomes kind of toxic. I mean, they have in some ways a point in that there is a difficulty the government has not resolved, which is how do we get a bespoke Brexit when the EU won't give us one? How do we get a Brexit when neither Canada or Norway, the two sort of mooted models, satisfy neither wings of the Tory party? And so, May's strategy has been for some time to decouple the end state solution of Brexit from the transition arrangements. But that game can only be played for so long. And I think this is what Brexiteers are calling her out over. Now, there's some of it can be shadow boxing. Some of it is about saying that the civil service have got you, madam. But some of it is actually more political for May, because she has to be able to deliver something at a point in which it can be accepted by everybody. And it's the timing of it which makes it interesting, which is why the EU isn't helping much by sort of telling her to get a move on, to be honest. I mean, so it's an interesting political moment, I think.
OK, and Tom, there's clearly disagreements around that cabinet table today. Boris and Amber are not exactly on the same page, but if we accept what the government is trying to do, which is this ambitious bespoke deal, which is neither Canada-like nor Norway-like, then there probably is some agreement they can reach on an opening gambit. And we've heard today about the so-called three baskets approach, which I'm going to try and explain very quickly. Basically, some parts of our economy get to diverge immediately. Other areas, we reach the same standards, but by different means. And in third areas, we remain aligned. Now, the EU today have said, No, that's not going to work for us. Why is that?
Well, because I think for the EU, they see that essentially as being have your cake and eat it. So where you think it's to your advantage, you'll go off and diverge. And where you think it's to your advantage to be aligned, that you'll behave like that. And I think their basic point is, look, the benefits and the burdens have to be lined up against one another. It's a kind of reasonable position, which is you can't
even
have your cake and eat it.
Even if it's a bespoke position.
Well, so I think there's a bit of confusion here between what is the meaning of cherry picking, which is what the EU won't allow, which is precisely this sort of bizarre three baskets approach, and what is a bespoke deal. And I think it's possible to have a bespoke deal, which is saying, look, we want something that is not exactly the same as Norway. It's not what Canada looks like. It is something new and different, reflecting the fact that our economy is differently structured and more integrated in the European economy than Canada is, but much larger than, say, Norway, and saying, OK, we want our own deal, and saying, well, the only way that we can have our own deal is if we're allowed to cherry pick and that somehow we think that we can have all the benefits and not shoulder any of the burdens. But those, I think, things have to be disentangled from one another. And at the moment, the debate really isn't helped by conflating them together.
OK, so to some extent, we just have to accept the parameters that trade deals exist within, or do we? Theresa May doesn't necessarily agree. But for all of that, Isabel, I mean, even the three baskets approach isn't good enough for a lot of Brexiteers. And they've really shown their strength this week with this letter from the European Research Group to the Prime Minister. I mean, what are their key demands, and why do you think they've chosen this week to set them out in this way?
Well, it's interesting that they did initially try to keep this letter private because they are trying, I understand, to build a better relationship with Downing Street. But I think they're coming from quite a low base, I have to say. But yes, as you say, that went well. And the suggestions that they've made include full regulatory autonomy, an implementation period governed by WTO principles, and a promise that new trade deals with third countries can be negotiated as soon as Britain officially leaves the EU. So this for them is basically saying, we want to get as far away from the European Union as we possibly can. And this is the split in the cabinet as well, actually. It's about Britain's future model. Does Britain want to leave the European Union but maintain as close ties as possible with it as its biggest trading partner? Or does actually Britain want to try to go to the rest of the world and leave the European Union, which a lot of these Brexiteers think is sort of dying economically behind?
And they want that from the moment of transition.
Yeah, and they're again very agitated about this prospect that the transition period could go on and on, because they think that the transition period is basically the Brexit that the Remainers want and that they'll never get out of it.
Q Hotel California. Tom?
Yeah, I mean, the problem with this whole approach is that it's presenting a very false choice, right? They're saying, on the one hand, you could be trading with Europe, and the other is the sort of global Britain. Actually, that's not really the choice that's on offer, because at the moment, the EU has trade deals with 50 countries around the world, in addition to the 27 in the EU. And as a result of that, in the last 15 years or so, actually, the proportion of Britain's trade that is with the single market has been declining, not increasing, over the last 15 years. And the reason for that is that as the EU has struck these trade deals around the world, it's actually internationalised the British economy. So the British economy is now more global, but it's doing that through the framework of the European Union. So one thing that people need to be really clear about is that that strategy described by the European Research Group isn't a strategy for a global Britain, it's a strategy for a parochial Britain, right? Because it's actually saying not only do we not want to be trading with the single market, but we don't want a customs union, we don't want access to those 50 deals
well,
that around the world.
Well, except that they believe that they can grandfather those deals.
Well, they assert that they can, but there's no evidence to suggest it. And there was that rather amusing Foreign Office note that sort of said, we know we said Brexit means Brexit, but it really doesn't mean Brexit. So for all intents and purposes, please just, you know, act as if Britain's still a member of the EU. I mean, it was embarrassing. And what it opens us up to is every single country can say to itself, well, in this case, we're going to choose to interpret you as being a sort of continuity member of the European Union because that's in our interest. But this case, it's not in our interest. So we'll assume that you've left.
So the third countries will be trying to cherry pick too.
Well, of course they would. I mean, that is exactly the strategy that they'll pursue. But I think people need to be a bit clearer about what has actually happened with British trade over the last 15 or 20 years. And that is that it has internationalised through the EU. And this false choice between a sort of European Britain and a global Britain isn't true at all.
And Randeep, just on the politics here, I mean, the European Research Group sounds very innocent, but we know they are some of the most ardent Brexiteers in the Tory party. And they gave us all their names the other day.
Yeah.
Interestingly, 62 of them, not the 35 that Anna Soubry has suggested. That's enough to take down Theresa May. Are they trying to make a point here?
I think they were, yeah. I mean, 62 is greater than the 40-odd names that Graham Brady needs, for example, for a leadership challenge.
Chair of the
1922 committee and overseer of the rules for who's elected leader. Yes, they are. And they are, in effect, I think, a party within a party. Much more of a threat to the leadership than, you know, momentum might be a support to Jeremy Corbyn. They affect a different kind of policy stance. They seek to change policy from within. They are seeding the ground, I think, for a schism in the Conservative Party. The Tory party has been here before, over trade, the Corn Laws, and you know, it's dangerous ground. But these people are theological in their belief that Brexit is a good idea. They have been at it for more than 20 years. And, you know, there's a place for dreamers in politics.
I'm going to put that to Isabel because you're smiling. But also just to say, there are 62 of them, but it's quite interesting that while they're making their points, someone like Nicky Morgan, the Tory chair of the Treasury Select Committee, is teaming up with Yvette Cooper to make another point, which is that overall in Parliament, there's actually probably a majority for a soft Brexit, and that must have them quite worried.
Yes, I think the ERG need to sort of state themselves quite clearly as they do, because they feel like they are sort of in the minority in Parliament. And actually, just to take issue slightly with something you said, Randeep, which is that not all of them are Brexiteers. So this letter was written by John Penrose,
wow,
who backed Remain.
Do you believe that the few people in the ERG who backed Remain, people like John Penrose, Charlie Elphick, although I know he's not a Conservative right now, do you really believe that they were Remainers, or do you think they were just being loyal to David Cameron?
I think there are, to be fair, I think there are quite a few MPs and ministers who backed Remain for reasons that had very little to do with their views on the European Union. But I think it's handy for the ERG to have these people. And I think actually having John Penrose as the author of this letter rather than Jacob Rees-Mogg was another sign that the ERG are trying to be a little less politically threatening to Theresa May, even just as a sort of front, because actually, as you say, publishing your numbers, publishing your names does send a certain message, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say on that particular point, is it threatening or not? I mean, the style is somewhat irrelevant to the fact that the substance said, unless you go for this ultra hard Brexit, we can't agree to it. I mean, it was sort of no compromise whatsoever. The points in the letter, I thought the letter was extraordinary for that reason. They weren't sort of saying, look, there's a debate to be had, or we need to find the right place for the British economy, or any of those kind of things. It said, absolutely, we are fixed on the hardest of hard Brexits, and this is the fixed point that we have.
Although their arguments about what might happen in transition could be argued in a couple of different ways. I mean, even the government believes that you might be able to negotiate trade deals as long as you don't enact them until after we formally leave.
Yeah, I think that is the least substantial part of the point. One is saying we want to be on WTO principles. The other is saying that full regulatory autonomy, what that is really code for, is divergence with the EU. And the EU is saying, well, if you want to have preferential participation in the single market, then one of the things that you have to accept is that you will accept that the regulations need to be aligned. So that phrase on full regulatory autonomy was the one that really would blow the hole in any kind of serious trade deal.
I have to say divergence is a bit of a smokescreen, because we're not talking about divergence to raise from a floor. You don't get a series of regulations and think, I need to build on this. Divergence is really about undercutting the standards that the EU have put in place. And that, there's a sort of thing about the EIG with language, which they're very, very good at and adept at, because I think that, you know, these guys have been running the Tories' agenda ever since William Hague came out with a brilliant line saying that we want to be in Europe but not run by it.
OK, and just on that, David Davis this week has basically argued that, hang on, we don't want to get rid of red tape, we just want to make sure it's our red tape and it's a race to the top on global standards. Tom, IPPR came out with a report this week that was very sceptical of this idea of a race to the higher standards.
Well, so let's be really clear about regulatory standards. What they are at the moment is a minimum floor. What they're also there to do in terms of the rules is to make sure that you can't come up with sort of regulations that are masquerading as regulations to create high standards, but what they're really doing is preventing trade and competition, right? And that means that British producers can sell into France and French producers can sell into Germany and so on, because if you create some sort of spurious regulation that requires a standard that can only be met by a domestic producer to stop that kind of behaviour. So, yes, there are tiny examples like preventing the import of foie gras.
But generally, have the high standards.
But we can for the most part, already have the high standards.
And found the public does not support deregulation.
Well, so what was really striking from some polling that we've done as part of our Progressive Brexit programme is to look at the public attitudes, and the overwhelming level of public support for either retaining the regulations or actually making them stricter. And so support for deregulating, for loosening the regulations or removing them together, in many cases is down in the single digits. So take environmental targets, right? Renewable energy targets. Support for them to be relaxed and loosened is at 4%, and to be removed altogether is at 4%. So there's very, very little public support for what a lot of the hard Brexiteers have been telling us, which is, well, we'll deregulate and it's this great opportunity and it's going to be fantastic and we'll become wealthy through cutting back on regulation. The thing about regulation, regulatory divergence, as they describe it, this sort of deregulated approach, is that it has a really extraordinary political accomplishment of being both anti-worker by taking away worker protections and anti-business by creating a whole set of additional regulatory systems that means that complexity for business goes up. So it is a sort of somewhat absurd position to pursue, to be both anti-worker and anti-business at the same time.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, life expectancy in England and Wales is stalling, even falling in places, and four academics say austerity could be driving this unprecedented trend. Good news for the pension industry, which is reducing estimates of its future liabilities. But it leaves Britain falling behind in Europe. Joining me now is one of the authors of a new study that says the Department of Health is ignoring warnings. Danny Dorling, Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. So can you just explain what is happening with life expectancy, what the figures are, and how have you warned the Department of Health about that?
With life expectancy in Britain, it has begun to slow down improving. For decades, until about 2010, it improved by about a third of a year every year. And then after 2010, the improvement slowed and slowed and slowed. So it's really just inching forward now. Between 2010 and 2015, if you look at the European Union figures, they round it to the nearest year and get no improvement for the UK, whereas every other country in Europe had life expectancy rising between 2010 and 2015. And we've been looking at this for years now. It is not getting better. And we've got to the point of saying the Department of Health, if they're not going to look at this, somebody else needs to look at it.
And what do they say when you raise this with them?
The Department of Health, I think they have a press officer who doesn't know much about health, to be honest. And they just come out with, we're spending more on the NHS than ever, people are smoking less. They have a set of standard answers, which they press a button and simply release. That's what they do.
And in general, what could be causing this? What makes you say that it might be austerity?
Well, because we looked at everything else. I mean, when this first happened, it first became obvious in 2012 and 2013, and first of all for elderly women who are dying a bit earlier than before. And we looked at many causes. So when we looked at things like influenza and we looked at whether there was a particular weak age cohort, whether people born in the past had their health damaged. And we began to rule these things out. The one factor that is, you know, which stays all the way through is that we've had enormous cuts in social care spending, in particular in visits to elderly people and in the NHS and in care, cuts in real terms. The groups which are now seeing increased mortality, actually getting worse, are the poorest babies. Their infant mortality rates are now rising significantly, statistically significantly. And people living in the poorest areas of Britain, particularly elderly, frail people, and particularly women, because women are more likely to be living on their own than men.
And what does it mean for their lives? What's going to change?
What happens is that people are ill for longer, and in many cases and in many areas are actually dying a little bit earlier than they were a few years ago. Whereas elsewhere in Europe and in Japan and elsewhere in the rest of the rich world, people are carrying on seeing life expectancy rising and health getting better.
And are they spending more on their social care systems?
Oh, yes. I mean, in Germany, if we wanted to spend the same on health as the Germans spend, we'd have to spend an extra £1 billion a week. Switzerland spends the most. It spends twice as much per head as us. We're kind of at the level of Greece, though, for our spending. We have a very efficient NHS. It's an incredibly underfunded NHS.
And this doesn't only affect the Department of Health. The Department for Work and Pensions have used life expectancy predictions to increase the state pension age, in fact, to accelerate that increase. Now, some people would say they're catching up on previous increases in life expectancy, but do you think they should now put a hold on that?
Well, they can't. The Office of National Statistics has produced the latest estimates for the future, and they have 1 million fewer years of life being lived now in Britain in future than we thought 2 years ago. 1 million fewer years. The private pension funds have taken $300 billion off their liabilities because life expectancy is not rising hardly at all now. So you cannot. I mean, it's a terrible situation we've got into where we don't have to worry so much about future pension liabilities because we're such an awful country when it comes to public health.
So what does it actually mean in terms of how long people can expect to live?
Well, women in the UK can expect to live about 82 and a half years, and that compares to almost 86 in Spain, the same in France, about 85 in Italy and Luxembourg, 84 in Finland, 84 in Portugal, in Sweden, Malta, Slovenia, Greece, they live longer, Cyprus, Austria, Ireland, Belgium, the Netherlands and Germany all live longer. Men can expect to live for about 79 years in the UK. And again, in most affluent countries in Europe, people are living longer, and in Korea and in Japan. Only really the United States does worse than the UK for a large, rich country.
And of course, you're talking averages, but presumably that means more people dying in their 60s, more people dying in their 70s.
Yes, and particularly more poor people. So this is particularly affecting the poorer groups in the population. Even for richer people with private pensions, the private pension providers have reduced their estimates of what they're going to have to pay out. But they say the effect is larger for poor people. And the saddest one is babies born to the poorest mothers in England are now more likely to die in their first year of life than they were a few years ago.
Danny Dorling there. And now, Agent Cobb. That is what a former Czechoslovakian spy has claimed was the code name for one Jeremy Corbyn in the 1980s. Jan Sarkozy said the then backbencher was one of a number of his paid informants in the Labour Party. Sounds like story gold, until you consider this. Jan Sarkozy also claimed to have organised Live Aid and said Corbyn was telling him what Margaret Thatcher had for breakfast. And Czech authorities have poured scorn on what appears to be the lies of a fantasist. Corbyn himself admitted meeting the spy 3 times, but says he thought he was a diplomat and threatened to sue an MP who accused him of selling secrets. But that hasn't stopped the right-wing press having a field day with this one, resulting in Corbyn issuing his own video, direct via social media, with a warning to rich media barons, change is coming. Blimey, what a week. Joining me to discuss it is The Guardian's Matthew Dancona, who wrote this week a column entitled "The Worst View to Take on Corbyn's Czech Connection is Who Cares?" Tell me why you wanted to write that.
Well, I certainly didn't want to suggest that it was essential to go very, very hard on it as a news story. What concerned me was the the reaction of that I was detecting around some people, which was that it just didn't matter. It seemed to me that there were, you know, it was perfectly legitimate to criticise Corbyn for being in contact with a Czech diplomat and to accuse him at the least of some naivety there, and perhaps even to interrogate his views on the relationship between the West and the Soviet bloc during the Cold War. That was fine. And it was also fine to say that it was, you know, of a piece with his long-standing belief in diplomacy and dialogue, and you'd expect someone like him with his interests to be in contact with people on all sides during the Cold War, as he was during the Northern Ireland Troubles, and to defend him vigorously on that basis.
Although you didn't, of course, take that line.
No, although I'm of the view that during the Cold War, the people who were caving up to Warsaw Pact diplomats were playing a dangerous game. But that wasn't really my main point. I mean, my main point was that the bigger danger than defending Corbyn is to say that the whole thing is just an irrelevance and the Cold War is now history and it really shouldn't be of any interest how he behaved. And the story is just a kind of unimportant smear.
So on that point, let me just ask you, because the story initially was essentially that Corbyn had had three meetings with a person he believed was a Czech diplomat. What I want to understand is it true, as some critics are saying, that there was no such thing as a Czech diplomat? They were all spies and therefore Corbyn must have known who he was talking to. Or were actually Conservative MPs also meeting with these individuals? I took note that Geoffrey Howe visited Czechoslovakia within this time period. Margaret Thatcher actually had meetings with Russian politicians during this period. So just tell me, how significant was it that this guy was a diplomat? Would Corbyn have known that he must be a spy?
Well, it would have been highly unusual for a diplomat in this context to simply approach Corbyn via, I believe, one of the peace movement representatives just for a chat. And a sensible MP would have been very reserved about it. Now, I'm not saying he would have known that the person was in intelligence, but it would have been wise to exercise a certain amount of caution. It is absolutely the case that a huge number of Warsaw Pact diplomats at that time and their successors today are undeclared intelligence officials. And, you know, given Corbyn's politics, they would have been interested in him for the reasons some people are suspicious now. I'm not suggesting Corbyn is a traitor. I'm not suggesting that Corbyn passed on secrets or took money or anything like that. My concern is really about the fact that I disagreed strongly with the argument that was doing the rounds in response to the initial Sun story, that this was ancient history and therefore not relevant.
Okay, and can I just ask you one thing on that point? Because, you know, there was a huge focus on Corbyn's previous views and relationships with the IRA during the election. And interestingly, it just didn't cut through with voters, or certainly didn't cut through with the voters that Labour was hoping to win over in that period. And one of the things I thought at the time was, for most people, the idea of talking to the IRA is something that governments and higher officials have actually done since then. So they have really no understanding of whether it would have been controversial at the time for Corbyn to have taken that view. And I think that the same thing possibly applies in this situation, which is perhaps we should talk about it and it is justified as an issue, but people won't care in political terms. Do you think that that is the case?
Well, there are two separate arguments there. The first is, if they don't understand the relevance, then it's one of the roles of the press to draw attention to it. Not excessive attention, but to explain why it matters. That's an analytical duty. A lot of voters won't have been around during the Cold War and won't have been around or at least interested in politics before the Good Friday Agreement and the talks that led up to it. But it is relevant. Is it going to affect voters' actions? I don't know, and nor do you, and no one can. I mean, I'm of the view that Corbyn's belief in diplomacy and dialogue is actually almost at the heart of the problem, because he is absolutely incapable of talking about anything else, as though everyone who's ever been engaged in any other form of action has not considered those options. I actually think Corbyn is a pacifist, which is a very different thing to being in favour of diplomacy, and I do think that's an important factor in a prospective prime minister. But that's my opinion, and it certainly isn't, you know, there is no rule that says it should be the thing that affects people's decisions at the next election. In fact, I suspect it probably won't be. I suspect the issues that determine the outcome of the next election will be much more to do with domestic issues, austerity, the incompetence of the incumbent government, Brexit clearly, and so on. And all that is absolutely correct. But equally well, I'd be failing in my duty as a commentator if I didn't say that I thought that it was important, and to say that it is important to keep an eye on the whole record and not just the recent record.
Matthew D'Ancona there. So, Isabel, this story has been very interesting all week, not only because of the actual story, but the debate that's had around it. Jeremy Corbyn decided to film himself attacking the right-wing media and put it out via social media. And interestingly, the BBC, ITV and Sky refusing to run that clip because he won't come and answer questions. I mean, what do you make of that?
Well, I think they've got to the sort of nub of what Corbyn was actually doing in this video, which was he said, here's a story that I don't like, which personally I think he probably has quite a good reason to be annoyed about as a story. And because I don't like this story, change is coming to the press. And we've heard arguments in favour of greater state regulation of the press before, which tend to use the stories of vulnerable people who've been screwed over by the newspapers. But this was one of the most explicit arguments by a politician about their own vested interests for regulating the media, which was, here's a story I don't like, I think the newspapers need to change as a result because I don't like it. And I think the fact that the broadcasters have pointed out that he doesn't take questions from them, and therefore they're not going to broadcast what I suppose the tabloids might describe as a bizarre video rant, shows that they think that this is about scrutiny and not actually about media standards.
But Randy, what he tried to argue in the video was that actually I believe in press freedom, but actually opening up the market and taking down some of these press barons, whatever he calls them, would actually improve press freedom.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I if I was advising Jeremy Corbyn, I would have said, you know, I can understand what you're trying to do, but I don't think you're going to convince people. Well, that's really not his intention. What he's trying to do is go over the heads of the established media and reach people beyond that, because he thinks he's got a mechanism to do that via social media. And actually, if you, the evidence of the election campaign is when he wasn't mediated, he was incredibly popular.
And so, a million people have watched this video.
It's not a bad strategy. I think where the broadcasters fail to realise is they don't look in on themselves and wonder whether they shouldn't have a few Corbynistas presenting some political programmes. Whether they shouldn't, I mean, a lot of Corbynistas, there's a very good young author called Alex Nunns, who's on Twitter a lot. He's written a very good book, The Candidate, on Jeremy Corbyn, complained vociferously about the fact he could never get on any programmes. And finally, he has got on some programmes. Now, it's not, I think broadcasters have something to look in on themselves and say, actually, we do have these people who are basically, you know, they're in the middle of politics, or they're Blairite or sort of soft Tories. We don't seem to have anybody else from, and there is a reasonable thing to say, you know, maybe we need to get somebody in who can represent those views, and maybe then you might get Jeremy Corbyn or John McDonald on.
But the broadcasters haven't taken up the suggestions by Jan Sarkozy that, you know, Corbyn was a spy. I mean, they really haven't gone beyond the original story of he met a diplomat three times. Should he be going on to those broadcasters to answer questions about that?
Because the questions that then, I mean, fine, they have an opportunity then to put all the questions that the Daily Mail and the Sun do, because there's nothing in this story. I mean, if there is, I would have assumed that Tory Central Office, the Sun and the Mail would have got something by now. But so far, they've got a guy who claims he set up Live Aid, Free Mandela, and knew what Thatcher had for breakfast, lunch and dinner off the back of three conversations with Jeremy Corbyn. I mean,
but should we find out what Jeremy Corbyn was talking about in those meetings?
Well, this is the issue. I think you've got to look at motive. So if you've got a source that comes to you, I mean, I'm not a journalist, but all of you are journalists. If you had a source that came to you and said, created Live Aid, I freed Mandela, and I used to know what Thatcher had for breakfast every morning, right? And this guy then says something about a current British politician. Would you say this is a credible source? I should probably write up what they say about the politician and splash it on the front page.
So I suspect probably, we can all agree not.
But not.
But what has not been denied is that he had three meetings with a Czech diplomat. Is that relevant?
But hold on. So the critique that you're getting back from Corbyn is to say, well, given that normal journalistic standards will say this person is a single source who has no credibility, you would not have the story in the first place. And so the point that Corbyn makes in that video is, well, what is the motivation for publishing something that is an embarrassment to anyone who's got a sense of journalistic ethics? So why would you do that? Well, there must be a motive, which is simply to attack Jeremy Corbyn under all circumstances. Now, if that is the starting point, there is some logic to Corbyn saying, well, why should I come on and answer questions about an attack that is simply there to attack Corbyn politically and isn't really a question about, you know, did Corbyn do that or did Corbyn do the other, rather than saying the real story here is why are the press reporting something that has such a flimsy basis and splashing it all over their front pages day after day. And I think, really, the people who have questions to answer in this are the newspapers that have taken a single source who has no credibility and put that on their front pages day after day. And by the way, the broadcasters will do their press review. They'll say, look at the morning papers and say, you know, look at these stories. So actually, I don't think the person who has got questions to answer in all this is Jeremy Corbyn. The people who have questions to answer are the press who are promoting a sort of fanciful story.
I think Jeremy Corbyn is using this. Take quite a lot of your points, particularly about single sources. But I think he's using this to argue for, you know, change is coming. Obviously, covers a great deal of things, but the briefings that we've had behind the scenes do suggest that this is about greater regulation of the press. And I think actually, if the newspapers have questions to answer, why doesn't Jeremy Corbyn sue them? Because actually we have very strong libel laws in this country, and he's arguing for something which actually already sort of exists. I know there's a convention for politicians not to sue unless it's a story about their private lives, but he's not exactly a conventional politician.
But Isabel, just on this, I mean, the Tories have taken advantage of it to some extent. You know, Ben Bradley has been threatened to be sued by Jeremy Corbyn for repeating some of the claims of Jan Sarkozy. Ben Wallace, Gavin Williamson came pretty close. And there was this extraordinary interview by Andrew Neil of Steve Baker yesterday, in which Steve Baker kept saying he's got questions to answer and wouldn't actually say, no, I don't agree that he's a traitor. I mean, do you not think it's political opportunism?
I don't think they should take this as an opportunity at all. I think they should stay well away from it, because I think they are falling flat on their faces repeatedly by trying to seize on this story. And I think they should have learned also from what they did in the snap election, which was every time Jeremy Corbyn talked about anything, whether it was benefits, you know, the deficit, well, not that he talked about the deficit, but any time he talked about anything, they go, oh, but the IRA. And actually, I mean, my family are from Warrington, which was blown up by the IRA. But most people can't actually remember the terror that the IRA caused. It's not culturally the same thing anymore. And actually, if people aren't put off Corbyn by talking about the IRA and by the fact that he actually invited convicted IRA volunteers to Parliament 2 weeks after the Brighton bombing, I don't think this stuff about the Cold War is going to have any power at all. And I think the Tories just look as though they're trying to repeat their silly IRA stuff during the election, which, by the way, isn't that great for those who were sort of affected by the IRA, because it looked like political opportunism again. I think they should learn from that, not do this with this really ropey story.
My thanks to my panel, Isabel Hardman, Randeep Ramesh and Tom Kibasi. You can follow all our political coverage at theguardian.com/politics. The producers were Phil Maynard and Simon Barnard. I'm Anushka Astana. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.